Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast that used to be all about comic book movies and TV, and now, having this week more than ever, is about whatever the hell we want. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to discuss Ernst Lubitsch's Design for Living are...
James Hunt.
And Reese Williamson.
Yeah, so this week we're on my bullshit. We're going back 90 years, 89 years in history to 1933 to talk about an Ernst Lubitsch romantic comedy, because, crucially, I think it's a very thematically similar movie to Challengers, which is coming out soon with Zendaya. Heard of her? Star of the Spider-Man movies? Your superhero nerds, you? So there's a tie-in, isn't it? It's fine. Anyway, before we get there, we're going to talk about what we've been watching. Who wants to go first?
Reese should go first. I always go first.
Yeah, well, I'll go first. I haven't seen a ton of movies since we last recorded.
Rube, why not? What have you been doing?
I haven't seen a ton of TV either.
Socialising,
a scumbag. I've watched a bit of Fallout. I'll do movies, but I'll just drop in that I watched like a couple of episodes of Fallout, which I thought was, as my friend put it in a text, just a little inert. It's sort of got a good pilot episode, and then you think, okay, here we go, we're off the races. And then it feels like, do we have different, do we have hot, what's happening? What's happening? What's going on?
What's going on? There's someone I know, right? And I'm not going to name any names, but there's someone I know who's also watched Fallout, who's watched all of it, and described it as a note perfect adaptation. That's incredible. So compelling and fun, and hopes it gets more.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's, I presume, Mr. Hunt on the call with us. He's in the room with us.
In the room right now.
Well, I'll just, I did only watch three, so I haven't seen the whole season, and I really like the pilot, so I think it's just two-thirds of the episodes I watched, I just found a little bit meandering, and I wasn't that intrigued by the guy who plays Maximus of the three kind of leads. I really like Walton Goggins. Ella Purnell just has like these giant, she looks like she's been drawn by the big eyes woman. She's got like the most huge eyes.
I spent a lot of time trying to work out if those eyes were CGI or not.
Yeah, is she Alita Battle Angel? Like, what is happening?
Oh, now we know why James liked it.
We'll wait. Well, no, because we all sort of chat if we've seen the same stuff. So, James, you talk a bit about Fallout.
I mean, so I'll caveat this by saying I'm a fan of the games, and I'm assuming you're not. Yeah. It uses the lore fantastically. It's got the feel of the games. It's got the look of the games. It's like such a respectful adaptation in a way that's like, it's not actively embarrassed to be a video game.
All I know about Fallout, James, is that little cartoon guy.
So the premise of the show is that it's... So first, imagine that instead of the present, there was a retro 1950s future in which everything is atomic powered and, you know, things don't run on computers, they run on sort of basic electronics powered by nuclear material. From that, jump 200 years in the future, there has been a nuclear war and humanity has pretty much fallen to pieces. A bunch of people are holed up in these things called vaults, where they've been living since the 1950s. Since the 2050s.
Could you say that they are fallout shelters?
Yes.
I see.
They've been living in these vaults, and, you know, people emerge to the surface to rebuild society and, you know, have to contend with what's up there. The thing that really intrigues me about this as an adaptation is it's not actually an adaptation. It's in continuity with the games. Which I don't think anything like that has been done before. Like, it's a proper sort of transmedia product.
Oh, it's it's in continuity with the games.
Yeah, yeah. Like, each game is a sort of standalone story set in a different part of this retro future apocalypse America, where you get new characters every time. You have the same sort of factions running around. And this is as far into the future of the Fallout timeline as any story has been.
So have these characters been in the games, or are they
No.
So they're all original characters just in the Fallout world?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are there any characters from the games in the season? Any named characters?
No. I mean it's rare even to get characters cross over from one Fallout game to another. Like, you might get a small nod. But generally speaking, they're complete entities of them in and of themselves.
I kind of just thought the Walton Goggins character was from one of the games, because he's so specific.
he's got
so much backstory, and
he's the Red Skull.
He's the Red Skull. Yeah, exactly.
Well, this is the thing. The sort of lore of Fallout is really well developed, and to be able to just sort of drop this new story in there and have it feel like something that was constructed, you know. It's not like it doesn't feel like it's overloading you with lore, or that it's trying to cram in nods and hat tips for the fans.
So,
like, it feels pretty organic.
Ella Purnell's wearing the blue and yellow outfit. So what's she? What's the, like, because that's Fallout iconography, right?
Yeah, that's the jumpsuit of the vault dwellers. So her particular vault is connected to, I won't spoil too much, but her particular vault is connected to two others. They've been living down there with a plan to emerge and rebuild society. One of the things that I think is funny about this one is they don't have big enough gene pools to sustain their own population, so they trade people between vaults, and that's one of the opening sequences. Is one of the opening episode's major sequences is Ella Purnell getting married to someone who crosses over from another vault, but who is not who they seem.
Okay, so Rhys, what's your fucking problem, man?
Because that is in the first episode, which I'm on record as saying was good. And what James isn't, you know, so it, the story is you're following three characters. The first episode structure is like you kind of get about 40 minutes on each character-ish. And she's one of them. And that's the kind of classic Fallout protagonist in the games as well, right, James?
You
generally will play a vault dweller, starts the game as a vault dweller, and then it's, you know, sort of leaves the vault.
Spat out into the wasteland, yeah.
Yeah, so she's doing that, and during the course of that first episode, and again, I'm not going to feel bad to spoil the first episode, she does leave the vault again. There's just a bit of story there. Then you meet a character called Maximus, who's a member of the Brotherhood of Steel, which I do remember from Fallout, I want to say, 3. How would you describe that? Like, it's sort of a military operation, but it's also, there's a religious aspect to
it,
right?
It's a sort of pseudo military / religious cult. And they're basically
a bunch
of fascists who have control access to technology. And yeah, their thing is they have these giant sort of pre-apocalypse Iron Man suits that they walk around in, pushing people around and, you know, proclaiming themselves to be the head of things.
And Joe, when we say Iron Man suits, like literally when he goes into the suit, you get the in, you know, the in helmet cam, and it is just the Iron Man.
Yeah,
sort of
although
thing.
I should point out, Fallout did it first.
What with that angle on the face, like that specific thing?
Possibly not not the face angle, but you know, the getting in and out the armor.
Oh yeah,
like
I'm not
that,
saying
yeah.
that the I'm not saying that Iron Man invented suits. I'm just saying that the thing where you see the camera is like. You know, because obviously the camera on in the Iron Man movies, it's sort of it can't actually be there, right? Because it's almost you wouldn't have a camera there because you wouldn't see through the face.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's sort of this strange artificial camera, and they do it's just the exact same.
The Holly from Red
anyway,
Dwarf view. Yeah.
Sure. So you get that, and I found that even in the first episode, just a slog, if I'm honest. I don't know, James, if you just fully disagree, but I found that a slog. And then he and his storyline, you know, just do come more prominent in episodes 2 and 3, the ones I've seen. And then Walton Goggins is, you know, you just get this great that the pilot opens on him, and it's in the pre-apocalyptic moment. So, and then he actually watches the bombs go off in LA, and then you know, he is clearly alive still somehow 200 years later, but as a kind of Red Skull type. And he's just fun. He's just, Walton Goggins is just really fun. And that's all that, I like all that stuff. But yeah, so that's, well, I don't know that, I'm not even sure that I would keep watching. I don't think. But the fact that you liked it a lot, maybe makes me reconsider.
Yeah, I mean,
but it's got that boy. It's got a boy's flavor to it. It's very violent at times, but it's gory, but in a kind of in a silly way. It's all quite glib, to be honest. You know, a little nihilistic. But I think the boys is more. It's the stuff of the boys I've seen. I have enjoyed more than the Fallout I've seen. But anyway,
I was just going to build on that very quickly. Walton Goggins, who is always good, right? And the way you're talking mm-hmm. about him was just reminding me of how good he is in Justified. I've been also watching, and I don't want to talk about this huge amount because I don't think it's very good. We're watching the Death and Other Details with Mandy Patinkin and Violet Bean on Disney+. And that's got Jerry Burns in it from Justified. It's like a murder mystery kind of thing.
Is that the one on the boat?
Yeah.
Is that the bow one?
Yeah. it's kind of silly, but we've been watching it and it's fine. But Jerry Burns is in it, who was also in Justified, and just hearing you talk about that and having the little dose of him from that is making me want to go back and watch Justified again, because there's that was a show like which was a character actor showcase, both in its like series regulars and then the villains that it cycled in each season. Oh, that was a good old time.
In fairness, one of the things that's great about Fallout is the cast. Like, it's full of sort of slightly familiar faces who are doing their character actor thing.
I've just been scrolling through IMDb. I see Matt Berry turns up.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
Michael Emerson, my dude. Michael Emerson, Ben Linus.
Ben,
Linus.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in the second episode.
There's people from Mr. Robot. There's people from...
well, I mean, don't. Let's not.
Severance.
Turn this on it, James.
Kyle MacLachlan's in it. It's good. Mm-hmm.
Sarita Chowdhury.
Yeah. I mean, the thing for me that sort of satisfied me was that, unlike Reese, I felt like every episode was substantially moving the plot forward in and developing the mystery in sort of interesting ways. Like, it doesn't feel like when you watch those Marvel shows and what you get is 40 minutes of people walking from location to location, having a conversation, and then the one plot beat happens at the end.
Like, they get a new costume.
Yeah.
I felt like episodes two and three were that, to a point, perhaps,
but I think the essence of the Fallout games is exploring the wasteland, trying to put the puzzle pieces together, and encountering sort of these hideous tableaus along the way. Mm. So for me, even the bits that didn't necessarily feel like they had a point, some of them come back. Some of them just add to the texture of the world for me.
Right, we've gone deep on Fallout. Reese, what else did you watch?
We've gone deep. Ripley. I watched 5 episodes of Ripley, so that's, I'm not done with that quite yet. That is, I think, pretty fantastic. Episode 3 in particular is one of the best episodes I've seen in a long time.
What's it doing, Reese? Is it the talented Mr. Ripley, or is it a different story from the...
No, it's a pretty much straight adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley. Not that I've read the book, but
isn't there something like the fifth screen version of Ripley that's been done or something? I saw.
Yeah, well, I think it's only the third adaptation of Talented, but I think there are another 2 Ripleys. It's not the fifth adaptation of Talented, though, right?
No, just the fifth of that character. Yeah.
Yeah, then you've got Malkovich did one in the 90s, and Wim Wenders did one in the 80s, and so I think that's the 5, yeah, plus some radio plays and stuff. But this is just it's just really good filmmaking, I would say. It's beautiful. It's Robert Elswit cinematography, black and white, looks incredible. The New York in episode 1, and then they kind of, and then it moves to the Italian town for episodes 2 and lead to 4 or 5. And so it looks amazing. And it's just so, it does remind me of, so Steve Zalian, I don't know if it, the last project of this, but did The Night Of, which I think also I just thought was amazing when I watched that. Me and my fam watched that over lockdown, even though it was, you know, from a ways back. And I just remember really being compelled by all of the kind of process that show was interested in, or the process of moving through the you know, the American justice system, and then all, you know, also filled with great characters and great acting and a mystery, and so you had all that, but just the way you'd follow Riz Ahmed's character, like through how you know, how a typical day in the life of a jailed man, all excellent, all the legal stuff, all of that. And there's so much of that in this. There's just lots of like watching Andrew Scott as this sociopathic Ripley, just, I don't know, like it's, I can't describe you how compelling it is to watch him like rearrange sort of items on a dresser. And it's just great. And there's just tons of that stuff in it. There's like amazing Foley. And then the third episode, I'm not going to spoil what happens in the third episode, but it is, there's an event in the third episode, and then you get about 45 minutes of almost silent sort of action from Andrew Scott, and he's going to kind of get out of this predicament, and it's so good. So I would really recommend Ripley.
What I feel slightly allergic to, though.
Mm-hmm.
A story that I've already seen told over a feature length, then being, you know, told over 3 or 4 times that amount of screen time. So is there a, like,
yeah.
I am a person who generally I'm like, cool, what's that? Oh, it's a TV show. Like, could this have been a movie? Does it feel additive
for me?
To,
so watching
what you get out of the Miguel movie, because that's which bears mentioning, right? Sounds Mr. Ripley,
yeah, yeah.
Fucking rules. It's great. Great,
yeah,
movie.
I think where what helps is I haven't seen that in probably 10 years at least, so I don't know that I have a ton of working memory of that movie, but also like watching this and watching Fallout at the same time, to me there's so much more instant in this show on an episodic basis than in the few Fallouts I've watched. So just as a, you know, comparison from those two, yes, I mean, the what you might recall as a major event from the movie, that does happen in the third episode, and that moves the story along in the dramatic direction. So I don't know, it's going to be interesting. I would like to rewatch the film when I'm done with the show, because it doesn't, yeah, watching it in real time, what just watching it, it doesn't feel like, oh, this has been drawn out. It just doesn't. But also part of that is the pace of the show is slower. So it's, again, there's all this methodical process stuff that means that the pace of the episodes are slower, but the level of it, but it doesn't feel slower than you want if you're into the vibe of it, you know.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it. I can see they're like the lead trio. Who plays the Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Yes, so it's Dakota Fanning. It's Johnny Flynn. The Philip Seymour Hoffman character is played by Sting's non-binary daughter, I think daughter. So that's who
is that
plays
Elliot Sumner?
Freddie. I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
But they are the one actor that I, and yeah, you're right. They're very, you know, they're prominent. And that's the actor that I wasn't really familiar with of
okay.
the other,
interesting.
You know, the main cast. So Ripley, I would recommend. I think if you don't like the first episode, you're not, you know, it's a vibe thing. And if it's not for you, it's not for you. But I thought it was really good. And then quickly, I guess I watched Monkey Man. Oh, yeah. Which I really liked. Yeah, really liked. I'd say it's sort of maybe disappeared from my mind a little quicker than I would have expected. But there's some really good action sequences. Dev Patel looks great.
Is it a bigger sell on Dev Patel, the director, or Dev Patel, the leading man?
I'd say the bigger sell is just the kind of the world and the milieu and the, you know, this grubby action story taking place in, you know, in an Indian city. I think that's, for me, that's the kind of USP of it. But those other two bits, you know, the action sequences are really, are really funnily well put together, really exciting. There's loads of like really grubby hand to hand shit. It's great. It's a little generic. You know, the world feels very non-generic, but the story is quite, you know, you watch the trailer, you can kind of, you'll get the beats of this. It's a revenge story. And I think there's a bit when they reference John Wick earlier in the movie, they actually say they say his name, you know, not that it's in universe. I mean, they say, what is this, a John Wick movie? And I do think like, because it's, you know, it is not quite on the level of a John Wick 4. So, I think you've got to be careful when calling out your influences, because you don't want to remind people of a movie that they might prefer to be seeing. And even though I really liked it, John Wick Chapter 4 was more fun and better, and the action sequences were way more inventive and exciting. But Monkey Man was good. And then I've seen The Fall Guy. I went to like a exhibitor screening of The Fall Guy,
ooh,
which comes out
fancy.
Next week.
Is it good? Because we've been looking forward
Fall
to
Guy,
that.
Fall Guy, really fucking good.
So okay,
good.
Wow.
The
trailer
really
has the vibe of
excellent.
this is either going to rock or going to be. I mean, because I feel like there's the genre that I've become more allergic to than anything is action comedy.
Action comedy. I can't have
a comedy movie anymore. It has to be an action comedy. And I'm like, oh, do I really need to see, I don't know, Kumail Nanjiani picking up a gun now?
I think what isn't in all the marketing, and it makes sense that they're selling it on what they're selling it on, but the things to tell you that after you watch the film is it's actually way more of a true romance between those two characters than it appears. I think so much time is spent on getting you to invest in those two characters, you know, getting together, which totally worked for me because they have great chemistry, but also, you know, it feels like it kind of feels like a real adult relationship, and that's not something that I would have thought having seen just the trailer or the poster, or the fact that it's based on a TV show from the 80s. But you get a real adult relationship story in there. And Emily Blunt, you know, it gets tons of screen time. She isn't just the female sort of plus one. She's in it tons. And then the other thing that is so relevant to it is how much about stunt work it is, and I just felt the director David Leitch, you know, he just was clearly pouring so many interesting details into the stunt stuff in the movie, because for those who don't know, the premise is like quite a simple, nice premise. Ryan Gosling is a stuntman. At the very start of the movie, he has a big accident, and he's sort of in this flirtatious, sort of quite light romance with Emily Blunt, who's a DP. But at the start of the movie, he has this big accident, and then you cut to a year later, and he gets a call from a producer, and him and Emily Blunt have kind of sort of he just disappears from the world after his injury, and he's just like a valet in LA. He gets a call from the producer played by Hannah Wanigham. She says, "You've got to come to Australia." Emily Blunt, who's now making her first movie as a director, she needs you as to work on this movie as a stuntman. Please, you've got to come out. So he goes out, but it turns out that Hannah Wanigham just made that up because they needed the stuntman. And actually, she needed him because the star of the movie, Aaron Taylor Johnson's gone missing. And he, because he knows the guys, she wants him to find him. And Emily Blunt is surprised to see him. So that's the whole premise. But it's so they just, the movie is kind of by day, you see them making the film. And that's filled with all that really fun Hollywood details, if you like that stuff. And then sort of by night,
he is
in the underworld of Australia, like tracking down or trying to track down Aaron Taylor Johnson. And then those sequences are filled with, you know, basically each one of them is built around like a very elaborate action sequence. But when I say action, it's almost more, it's like a stunt sequence, right? That's clearly the focus of each of the action beats. Like, let's just do like one really cool stunt. And we're really going to show it off in a great way. And there's no, you know, there's very little CGI in here. It's all practical. It's Gosling plus stuntmen. So for me, those elements to the movie, I found, really worked for me and really scratched interesting itches that I'm not sure I was expecting to get scratched.
So it's better than Bullet
Train. And it's funny and the action's great. It's much better than Bullet Train. Yeah.
Good.
And it's because the writer is Drew Pearce. Is the writer, and he's just, he's interesting. He's an interesting kind of witty ideas writer. And you just really feel that influence as well. And he's the sole credited screenwriter. So Fall Guy, like really, really good. Really, really good. And I think you guys will both really vibe with it. And I hope it's going to make a load of money because it's the kind of movie that Hollywood that should be making, because it's not an IP. It's not IP. It's being sold on these movie stars. And
sold
it's
on movie stars. That's cool, isn't it? I do like.
Yeah.
20 years ago, I give a fuck. Now you're like, oh my god, yes, give me this trailer that has been sold on the strength of two faces, two beautiful, beautiful faces. I don't want to see them smooch.
and their personas and sort of. And it's not Gosling like working at a different level or Blunt. They are kind of giving you like exactly what you want from them. And again, I think movie stars sometimes can get a bit lost in their own bullshit. And it's like, no, Ryan Gosling, just you do something so well that you have become a movie star. Give the audience exactly that, and this movie is that. And Emily Blunt similarly doing exactly what we want from her. I think really good.
Do you remember when, I mean, Ryan Gosling kind of emerges as like. Well, he's a Disney kid, and then he kind of reemerges. He goes through his like pretty young actor phase, then kind of reemerges after Half Nelson as like an indie movie star and does stuff like Lars and the Real Girl, and then builds up a bit of cred, and then he goes through his weird phase after doing Drive with Nicholas Winding Refn, and they do the follow up movie to that everyone hates, and then he goes off and directs his own movie, which is. Vibes of Only God Forgives and Everyone Hates. I feel like we've forgotten that guy and that he's just fully rinsed his movie star persona now. And obviously, I think emerging the other side of Barbie, he can do whatever the fuck he wants, can't he? And kind of refreshing as well that he's not attached to any major franchise.
Someone asked me to say, does it end with like, you know, sort of links up to the sequel? And I'm obviously not going to spoil the ending, but I think it doesn't. It really tells like one specific story that feels completely finished by the end of the movie. Can they make sequels? Of course, you might find an excuse to make a sequel, but that's also nice. It doesn't feel like this is Gosling setting up his own franchise. It's just a great, you know, it's just a great Hollywood movie. As good as they get, you know, this kind of thing.
Amazing. Have you got anything else, or should we?
No, that's me.
Okay, James. I guess we've already done one of your big ones. So, what else have you got for us?
Yeah, I mean, so most of the stuff I've been watching has been Fallout because we just sort of binged an episode a day, for the week and a half after release, and then I've been playing Fallout. I went back to Fallout 4. Yeah, it's very amusing to me that having had this sort of massive hit TV show, the only games you can play are almost 10 years old.
Oh, is that true?
It's the classic mismanagement of their own franchise that Bethesda is known for, which is they've got a big tie-in game, a tie-in TV show that is number one on Amazon, and yet the last proper Fallout game came out in 2016. And there probably won't be another one until close to 2030, because they take that long to make.
I feel like I have read this week or on a tweet, is Fallout 4 the best-selling game in Europe? Like, is that crazy?
It's not outside the realm of possibility. I don't think it would outclass any of the GTAs.
No,
I mean, it's certainly up there. Like, there's a reason the TV show is
1997.
Yeah, they made so in the 90s they were like isometric sort of strategy games, and then they came back in the Xbox 360 era with the first sort of fully 3D RPG version.
And so, what are all the spin-off things? What's Fallout 76? What's that?
Fallout 76 is.
Can you tell them on Wikipedia?
Fallout 76 is like an online live service game, where you build settlements, and it's using the Fallout 4 engine, but there are no, or at least at launch, there wasn't like a story and NPCs and stuff. It was all, you know, just an MMO. I think they've since added in some characters because people were like, this is shit, but yeah. Wow,
that's crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, I've been doing that. The only other thing of note that I've watched is probably Timer, which is Jack Schaefer's movie.
Good movie. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. It's kind of like, do you guys know the premise?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So,
do you know who Jack Schaefer is?
Main director on WandaVision?
Yeah.
Writer, I think. Creator, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So this was her first movie, I believe, that she wrote and directed. I've forgotten her name. Anya from Buffy.
Emma Caulfield,
yeah. And it's about...
Oh, so it's pre-WandaVision, right?
Yeah, it's from 2010.
Okay.
And it's about a world where they've developed these things called timers that you can have implanted in your wrist, which will count down to when you meet your soulmate. To the day you meet your soulmate. It's kind of like, you know, as my girlfriend described it, as a kind of Tumblr alternate universe fan fiction story. Which, you know, it's that kind of thing.
Black Mirror-y concept.
Black Mirror is what I went to when I watched it, yeah. I was like, oh, this is like a Black Mirror.
Definitely with a more optimistic vibe.
Yeah, like, part of me thinks maybe a Black Mirror episode would have been a better place for the story if it was just more upbeat. Like, as a feature, it slightly feels like it's treading water at times. But good cast. Like, I'm going to pull the cast up so I can name check the guy.
Michelle Ball, if I remember, is good in it. She's like the best friend or sister, maybe?
Sister, yeah.
Sister.
Yeah, she's very funny, despite the extremely early 2000s fashion she's wearing. I mean, that's kind of a problem for all of them. They're, like, very fashionable for the time, and that makes it, like, I don't know. But I was getting, like, flashbacks to, like, oh, God, people did used to dress like this. the guy she falls in love with... He's called Mikey, somehow not on the front page of IMDb.
John Patrick Amadori.
That's the one. He's very funny, considering, like, he's charming and he's got this kind of Adam Driver, Keanu Reeves energy.
Considering he's the rest of his career, he's a bit of a nobody.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that it didn't lead to anything for him, but he's good in it. And Emma Caulfield's
a lollipop hipster in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World.
Yeah, he's also in Almost Famous.
Oh.
Just like for a second or something. But yeah, I think it's as you know, sort of high concepts. I guess it's a rom-com. Not so much com, but I enjoyed it. The thing for me that made me go, oh, it's one of those movies, is that the lead character is obsessed with the fact she's about to turn 30. And I was like, that is the kind of thing only people in their late 20s ever think about.
And can you remember back to that, James?
What, to when?
to when you were in your late 20s.
Yeah,
You're famously so old.
I had no anxiety about turning 30, although I do remember the year after I was like, oh shit, I'm going to be 31.
I think for our generation that's become 40, because we're adolescent through our 20s.
Yeah, I mean, Emma Caulfield's character is so together for someone in her late 20s. Like, she's got a massive house. She's got like a proper job as an orthodontist or whatever. Like, it's mad. Anyway, the thing with her character is her timer is blank, and that means like she doesn't know if she'll ever meet the person she's looking for. So yeah, it's a fun movie. It's a fun movie.
Yeah, I liked it. I watched it after WandaVision because I'd been Jack Schaefer pilled, and yeah, liked it.
I originally wanted to watch it when it was at the London Sci-Fi Film Festival in 2010, but I didn't get to it for various reasons. And then when
you were having a crisis about turning 30.
I'm trying to think, how old would I have been? I would have been, yeah, can't do maths in my head. 22 I would have been, so not too worried. Where was I going with that? Oh, yeah, so I wanted to go and see it, and then I saw it on Netflix, and I was like, no, now is the time that I'm going to watch this movie 14 years after I planned to.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else?
Honestly, that's pretty much it. I picked up Star Trek Discovery again for the final season. Dog shit as ever. Mm. I don't know why I bother. I've been watching Star Trek
Voyager. Have you watched all of it?
Star Trek Discovery, yeah, of course.
So, but you're aware it's dog shit.
Did you ever like it? Because I watched like the two seasons, I think.
I was more positive about it than most people for the first couple of seasons. I was like, you know, it's trying something different. That's interesting. It's got a different vibe to normal Star Trek. Like, I'm interested. The end of season two, I was like, oh, this is very poorly written. And then it's only got worse since then.
Yeah, the end of season two was a real red flag to me, where it just kind of went, but what if it's fine?
Yeah. Now that we're going to have a big fight, like, yeah, and everything will be fine.
Last 10 years of Star Trek feels like a bit of a roller coaster. You know, the Abrams movie and then the sequel. Those kind of felt like events, I think. And then the TV stuff starts.
16 years ago.
Get out of here. Fine. And then the TV shows start after the second movie, I want to say. The new ones?
I think after the third movie.
Okay. Then the third movie, then the TV shows. And then people were kind of excited for Discovery, and then people were just excited for Picard, and people liked Strange New Worlds. And then it feels like the last, I don't know, couple of years, a kind of quite quick reduction of, I don't know, emotional energy, actual output, and are we back to like, what the fuck is this franchise now?
Well, there's a lot of it, isn't there? And I think there's a lot of it with, from what I can tell, varying levels of quality.
Yeah, part of the problem is that CBS has sort of mismanaged the production to the point where there was a moment sort of last year, 2 years ago maybe, where they had five different series of Star Trek coming out at the same time. And then they've now, one of them sort of concluded, two of them are hitting their final seasons. One of them doesn't come out that regularly. Like, they're about to go down, and they managed
almost
to,
as if they had a new streaming service that needed content on it.
Yeah, well, quite. Yeah. This is the thing. They put out Prodigy, which was great, and then removed it from their streaming service and cancelled it, yeah.
So, which one was Prodigy?
Prodigy was a Nickelodeon Star Trek series aimed at kids, but was
Live action or animated?
Yeah. Animated, CG. CG. It was good.
I like the one that's the one you like, James.
Yeah, I mean the one I like the one I like most is Lower Decks, which is a kind of Rick and Morty influenced, you know, franchise in jokes,
which they've just essentially cancelled, right?
Yeah, it's about to move into its final season. But that, for my money, is the most Star Trek of all the five shows. Although Strange New Worlds is also very good.
But so all that remains now, with more to come that isn't the final season, is Strange New Worlds.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And no movies in.
No movies.
Know, feeling like no movies are close, and the sort of J.J. Abrams world, like, seemingly just about now abandoned.
I mean,
right? Like, all the stars there are unlikely to return, I think.
Well, just quickly.
What has happened to this franchise?
Yeah. The thing to note is that CBS and Paramount control Star Trek in different ways. So anything on TV is CBS. Anything in the movies is Paramount. Paramount did just announce, again, a fourth movie.
In the same timeline?
In the Abrams timeline, presumably.
And do they have they asked the cast this time?
I doubt it. They've just announced that it's being written. So who knows?
There was an S.J. Clarkson movie at one point, wasn't there? And I think that's probably dead now.
Yeah, that is dead.
Yes.
The Tarantino one, dead.
Tarantino's not happening, thankfully.
That would be a twist of, you know, the post the movie critic bailing. That would be a really funny twist. If he's like, I've decided actually my final movie is going to, yes,
the 10th movie by anyway. Quentin Tarantino, piece of the action.
Feet. I think this has the whiff of like, get David Ellison on all this shit. I feel like I'd like to see the Sky Dance take on Star Trek. Because was he involved in the Abrams ones?
No, Alex Kurtzman was showrunning.
Yeah, get Ellison. He buys Paramount. Get day one problem to solve. Star Trek. Let's do it. Let's try it. Get Gareth Edwards on it.
So, in fairness, Strange New Worlds is properly brilliant. I would recommend that to anyone, Star Trek fan or not. But
by the time, like, it's long in the tooth now, really. Like, they need to be figuring out what comes after. How are they going to spin off because Spock and Kirk are in that, right?
Yeah, as like younger versions of themselves. Yeah,
you know, is that a potential next thing? You know,
well,
you
no. Next thing,
you have a new timeline.
The next thing, they're doing that one-off Section 31 movie with God, my name for actors,
Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah. So they're doing that as a one-off TV special.
Okay.
And they're developing the Starfleet Academy TV show that they've been threatening to make for decades. Because every time they announce it, everyone's like, do we really want to see Star Trek Academy?
Of eventually merged into the
Abrams movie. Yeah, because the original plan was
10 minutes at the start of the movie rather than the whole thing.
Yeah. There was a point where Starfleet Academy was going to be a TV show, then it was going to be a movie, then it was the Abrams movies, and then it ended out being a small portion of the first Abrams movie. But yeah, you know, the thing for me is Star Trek is doing good stuff. It's also doing bad stuff. And I'm a glutton for punishment in that I will watch it all, even Discovery, which is dog shit.
If it was announced tomorrow that they are making, they've announced a new Star Trek film, it's called Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and it stars Michael B. Jordan, how would you feel about that? Would you feel good about that?
How would I feel? Happy, you know. Yeah. Anything good. Anything that's trying something that isn't Kirk and Spock, I'll be very happy with.
Because that feels on the board. That feels left on the table. You just do movie adaptations of DS9, of Voyager.
Well,
probably stop there.
Well, and surely as well, like there's rope to do. I've always thought this, that there's rope to do. Like, what's the version of The Next Generation that takes place in the Kelvin timeline? What's the version of Deep Space Nine?
Yeah, I mean that feels like the obvious place to take the movies because then
you can kind of go. Let's do a first contact, but now it's a slightly different cast, and we can kind of, and try and avoid some of the missteps of Into Darkness. I think,
you know, realistically, Patrick Stewart is done with that character. Like, he may come back for cameos. He's not going to headline a TV show again. He barely made it through this one, to be honest.
I don't know.
Honestly, watching these shows going like, I fucking hope he doesn't die before this is over.
Yeah, but if he's being elder abused, which I think you have speculated on podcast before, man, whoever controls his estate is going to just puppet him into, you know, he's going to be in Wolverine Deadpool.
He probably is.
Elderly puppet. You know, with some behind the scenes person just cashing
in.
It's gross.
He was in a Super Bowl commercial, wasn't he?
Was he?
He was, yeah.
Jeez.
Oh, he was like.
He shouldn't need the money. It's worrying.
It's elder abuse, man. We've discussed this. We've got receipts.
But it was
Paramount Plus.
No,
it was like him surrounded by other Paramount characters, like Hey Arnold.
SpongeBob, yeah.
That was
quickly fan cast. I've picked Michael B. Jordan for DS9. If they're doing a TNG, who's Picard now? If they're doing Voyager, who's Janeway now? Go.
What's his face from Jesus Christ?
It's the guy from Barry, the bald guy from Barry.
No, the
I'm bald
James McAvoy is Picard. Obviously.
Oh, come on.
Right, yeah.
So, and Janeway's harder.
Tom
Janeway.
Margot Martindale. Too young. No, they're both a bit. No, Natasha Lyonne a bit too young. That's fun, though.
No, she's not.
Natasha Lyonne is about to hit the right age, I think, just.
She would be too chaotic. She'd be bring too much chaotic energy to a Starfleet captain.
Yeah,
she'd just there smoking cigs in the captain's chair.
Yeah.
Hey, these Romulans. What's your problem with me, Romulans?
I'm no good with fan casting. I can't top that.
Joe, Janeway.
I've told you, Natasha Lyonne.
Okay.
She was so
we're not getting real answers from Joseph today.
No, Kate. Mulgrew was 40 when she was in. What's it? And Natasha Lyonne is 5 years older. She's 45.
Shit.
Who's the idiot now, Reese?
Yeah,
take me seriously. I demand to be taken seriously.
I think what's her face from The Good Place? That's who I'd choose.
A good shout. There we go.
Kirsten Bell.
That's the one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I thought you meant Ted Danson. As Janeway. Mr. Janeway. You woke mob. You don't get to have all of the genders go in that direction. This one's going another one. Danson's in. But he's old too. Whatever.
Anyway, that's what I've been watching. And, you know, the less said about it, the better.
Okay. I'm going to blast through a lot of mine because we've been
20 minutes.
We've been going for a while, but I'm aware that our discussion on the movie is going to be shorter, probably, than some others. So just to blast through a couple of things I've seen. I watched the Clint Eastwood movie Every Which Way But Loose. Are you aware of this is the Clint Eastwood and the Monkey movie, right? The orangutan. It got a sequel. Yes, I do plan on watching it. Just need to warn everyone out there, anyone who's expecting a Clint Eastwood and a monkey movie and what hijinks they get into, be warned that this is just a Clint Eastwood movie that happens to have a monkey in it. It's insane. The monkey is, I'm like, when are they going to introduce the monkey? How's the monkey going to come into things? And it's just that one day, you know, about 10 minutes in, he goes home, he opens his barn and there's a monkey in there. And it sounds like he won him in a bet like a year ago. So the monkey is already there. And then there is like this this romance and this lover that leaves him and he kind of tracks her down across the country and the monkey comes. But that's it. So it's like the monkey could not be in the... They could make the movie without the monkey and it would not matter. So insane to me that was a movie that got made in the 70s. But great. Every Which Way But Loose. I watched, guys, On Golden Pond. Are you familiar with On Golden Pond?
It sounds familiar, but I can't think why. I've never seen it, for sure.
Is it Peter Sellers?
No. This is a movie
that... Where he walks on the pond. Sorry.
That's right. Yes, Peter Sellers walks on the pond at the end of being there. This is a movie from 1981 starring a very old and literally on death's door Henry Fonda. and literally, like, he died the following year. And Katharine Hepburn, who you think might similarly be on death's door, but, like, lived for another 20 years. Because she was, like, nearly 100 when she died, maybe? But it's Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn as this old couple, and Jane Fonda is obviously daughter of Henry Fonda, is playing their daughter. It's a project that she shepherded, that she bought the rights to the book, or the play, maybe, I think, with an eye for her dad playing the role. And it went off, and it kind of won a fuck ton of Oscars, like, or it certainly won some notable Oscars. Like, Henry Fonda won Best Actor for it, and Katharine Hepburn won Best Actress for it. And I think that maybe Jane Fonda got nominated as well. I'm just trying to bring up the IMDb. So it was nominated for Best Picture. Supporting Actress, Director, Cinematography, Sound, Film Editing, and Score, and it won Actor, Actress, and Adapted Screenplay. But it's always in my head been this, like, shorthand for, like, that's a really boring movie about old people. Like, they're on the Golden Pond. It's old Henry Fonda and old Katharine Hepburn, and kind of one of these, like, and of course Oscar is giving, it's like, oh, these old legends turn up for one last big movie. Let's have a chance to reward them. Turns out it's really fucking good. I really liked it. And I'm kind of, I've not quite delved into my spreadsheet yet, but I would say that the nominations aren't unjustified. It's quite a sweet story. The kind of the meta narrative of Jane Fonda kind of reaching out to her dad, especially, Reese, you'll probably be aware of this because you'll have listened to the Jane Fonda series on You Must Remember This, but she was, like, quite radical lefty, doing lots of campaigning throughout the 70s and, you know, taking trips out to Vietnam and being quite vocal about the government, whereas Henry Fonda was this kind of old school Hollywood conservative. So there was a bit of a strained relationship there. So kind of having that meta narrative that sits over the top of it as well is really interesting. And it's just, I think, as well, one of those just middle-of-the-road, really well-told stories that is just about relationships, that has the right amount of incident in it. It also has a really good supporting turn from Dabney Coleman in it, who, like, is one of the five main characters and kind of the one who didn't get the Oscar nomination, which seems harsh. But, really good, and the kind of movie that I feel probably has an unfair reputation. I kind of had it down as a Driving Miss Daisy, and it's definitely not. So on Golden Pond, good. I took the girls, both of them, the 4-year-old and the 18-month-old, to the cinema to see Robot Dreams on my own without my wife over half term, and it was an experience. I did a little test.
Had you ever been to the cinema with them before? Just you and the two of them?
Yeah, so Evangeline is like a, you know, she's an old pro when it comes to the cinema.
She's a veteran, yeah.
Fuck loads of stuff. She loves it. She's really well behaved when we get to the cinema. She's figured out the toilet breaks now, so that's not as much of a problem as it was when she was younger. Genevieve, we took to see Migration the previous school holidays with the whole family, and we took her to that because she's obsessed with ducks and it would have felt like child abuse not to take her. So we saw Migration, and then prior to this cinema trip, my wife was taking Evangeline out for the day, so, and I had Genevieve, and so me and Genevieve went to feed the ducks because, as I mentioned, fucking loves ducks. And then after that, we went to the showcase to watch a re-release of Luca, which is a movie I love, and obviously hadn't had the chance to see it on the big screen before. So we watched Luca as a kind of like a test of like, how's she going to do sitting through this, and she was really chill and kind of managed through the whole thing and didn't try and run away, which is a big win. So I was like, okay, I'm going to try it. So I took Evangeline and Genevieve on my own to see Robot Dreams at the Broadway in Nottingham, which is a smaller independent cinema. And Robot Dreams is a movie without any dialogue. And so I think it's fair to say that I was very in my head about any distractions that Genevieve was causing to the rest of the cinema. Mm. So it was an interesting experience. she was suitably distracted by her snacks for the first half hour. She kind of then ran amok for the next half hour, and I had to take her out, so I missed 5 minutes in the middle of the movie. And then I brought her back in. She sat on my knee and fell asleep facing the screen for the last 45 minutes of the film, which was great.
So brutal review.
I ended the film with both of them. It was kind of the time of the day for the screening. I was hoping she would nap in the car on the way there. She didn't. So the reason she was a bit aggy was because she was tired and she just conked out. But Evangeline loved it. Afterwards, we had to go and pose with the poster in the foyer, and she hugged the carrots on the poster. She super enjoyed it. And so for anyone who doesn't know about Robot Dreams, it was Oscar nominated in the animated feature category. And it is, a dialogue-free movie about a dog who is lonely and orders a robot kit off the internet. Real Lars and the Real Girl vibes. And second reference to that movie in this podcast, builds the robot. They kind of become best friends, but it's like I would say there is like, I think there are romantic overtones to it rather than it just being a friendship movie. And
are they coded as male?
I would say, say there's no dialogue. I think that the dog is definitely coded as male, the robot's probably, but yeah, I would say so. And the first like half hour of the movie is them having kind of fun together and bonding and
sex,
developing
having gay sex with each other.
This very lovely relationship that's all happening in the ellipses between scenes. It's got a lot in common with Design for Living in that respect.
You just see poppers and condoms just like littering their floor.
And then they go to the beach, and robot rusts and can't get up. And dog is distraught and goes home and kind of gets his toolkit and everything that he needs. And then he goes back to the beach the next morning to collect robot, and the beach has been locked up and it's like it's not accessible until next spring. And he tries everything he can to get in there and he can't. And then the rest of the movie is kind of cut between dog trying to kind of grapple with his grief, but not giving up on eventually finding robot again. And then robot kind of sat on the beach having these dream sequences where he dreams different things happening and him finding his way back to dog. And it's really lovely. I think the Oscar nomination's totally justified. It's kind of very, very unshowy animation. Just a really lovely little story. And I won't spoil how it ends, but I thought it was one of the, like, Evangeline was originally, like, initially upset by the ending, and then we kind of had a 1 minute long conversation about what had happened and what it meant and what the characters meant to each other, etc. And she was completely satisfied. So I thought that's kind of a glowing endorsement of the movie, that it made her feel, it made her, you know, emotionally react, but that in a way that she could as a 4-year-old process. So yeah, thumbs up for Robot Dreams. What was really nice.
Better or worse than the Bluey movie?
Well, that's what we're building up to. That's what we're building up to, Reese.
Yeah.
quickly go through the other things. I've watched a couple of Spike Lee movies. I watched Summer of Sam and Get on the Bus. Won't go too into detail on those, but just think that I urge anyone that has the opportunity to go back and watch Spike Lee movies, particularly from the 90s, early 2000s. But that run he had of just really like documenting the black experience in America on cinema and all of these important issues and actually just hit and like representing different viewpoints within those conversations through sometimes really personal films, through sometimes more genre comedy. And there's a lot more to his filmography than just Do the Right Thing. He's got some really, really good movies in that era. And I was sat there watching these couple, and I was thinking, I think the only shame is that there wasn't a female director, a black female director of his kind of stature making films during the same era as well. Certainly not, I'm sure there were black female directors working and telling stories, but not probably at his budget level or with the notoriety that he had.
But also, Joey, there weren't other male black directors on this level during this period. He's kind of he's this amazing, you know, sort of industry like redefining figure, right? He paved the way for black filmmakers to follow, but it was probably not a hospitable, particularly hospitable environment for other black filmmakers at the time.
I mean, there was a few, wasn't there? There was like that kind of emerged, but kind of, I guess, quite a lot emerged through the hood, so you've got the Hughes brothers and John Singleton but I mean, Spike Lee for me is something else, and I'm working my way through his filmography, and there's some real good shit in there. I rewatched Big at the weekend. You guys like Big? What do you guys think of Big?
I remember liking it when I was a kid. Yeah,
yeah. So I watched it with my kids.
I worry that it would come across as creepy now.
Well, I mean, I think when you're a kid, it doesn't. There's definitely that element, right? Which is 14-year-old boy transported into a grown-up's body, who then has a romance in the back half of the movie with a grown adult woman, and they have sex. Yes, and yes, it's an adult body, but it was a kid inside that body. So yeah, the the discourse that would happen around a big remake today. But Hanks is amazing in it. I'd forgotten that he was Oscar nominated for it. That's a really cool Oscar nomination. Just to say that I'd totally forgotten that there was a sexual relationship in the middle of the movie, and definitely encouraged Evangeline to go for a toilet break when that was unfolding. Saw it coming, turned to Laura, said, I'd forgotten this was in it. Evangeline, do you need the cheese cover for me?
Grabbed her and ran out the room.
Yep. What's that? Is that a bird in the back garden? Oh, go look at that. So the big final thing is Bluey, which is released 3 episodes over the last couple of weeks, and 2 standard length episodes, and this one bumper, like half hour long episode. And I really like Bluey. Evangeline watched it for the first time and was in floods of tears at the ending, but she kind of distraught, but said through like sobs, these are happy tears, I promise, Daddy. and has then watched it multiple times and has managed to stay in control of her emotions more with every subsequent watch. But it's great. I kind of love that. For me, anyway, it's this thing that's grown into a cultural behemoth, but I feel very able to just tune out the noise and enjoy it with my kids. But also, it's one of those things where eventually we'll be like, oh, can I put something on the telly? And the little one will go, Peppa, Peppa. And I'll say, Obluey?
No chance.
I got Obluey? And she goes, yeah, Bluey. Yeah, Blue. yeah, Blue.
I'm well out of the Peppa Pig range, but I hated that so much.
Peppa's not very parent-friendly. But that's kind of what I think a little bit of a miracle of Bluey, that it is so accessible for families, that, like, you know, for the parents and the kids, and that I think both get lots out of it without it being that kind of late 90s approach of, oh, let's stick this joke in there for the dads, you know? Like, you know,
here's a reference to Back to the Future.
Yes. Yeah, or here's a slightly smutty joke that will go over the heads of the kids. It's just really lovely observational stuff, and what's quite nice and has been central, I think, to this run of three episodes, which, for anyone who's not Bluey-pilled, the first episode kind of establishes the idea that the Healer family at the centre of the show might be selling their house and moving elsewhere. And then the middle feature-length episode, the middle half-hour-long episode, is set around a wedding, but also with the central conflict of, is Bluey and her family going to be moving away to a different city? And I guess, you know, as a viewer of the show, are all of the characters that you've been watching around them, is they're going to, you know, are you going to have a different supporting cast when they get around to making more episodes? Which I'm sure they will. I think some people have been speculating that this is the show ending, essentially, but I would be surprised. And what's nice about that is that it's kind of a Bluey kind of has a linear progression. So there's been like three seasons of 50 plus episodes, and the characters are slowly aging over that period of time. They have birthdays. They've got a little cousin who was like just this feral little toddler who couldn't speak and just bit people, and now she's like this sweet little girl who's starting to communicate. And you are kind of seeing evolutions of relationships on this very micro scale, right, of these 7 minute long episodes of people changing and growing. And it's just, I think, a kind of a minor miracle, because especially with stuff that you consume as often as children's television when you're a parent, I must have seen every episode of Bluey like 10 plus times. I mean, I know this half hour episode, since it was released just over a week ago, I've personally seen it 4 times. My kids must have seen it between when they were with me and or their mum like 7 or 8 times. And yeah, that it doesn't start to grind on you or get irritating. And my big takeaway from it is, ignore any like hot takes or like deep dive reviews like about what Bluey means, and just because I think whilst it's an enjoyable show for adults, what's great about it is how much it works for kids. And if there is any adult who has been disappointed by this last episode of Bluey, I don't think it matters. I don't think it's as much as we all enjoy it, I don't think it's for you. And so, yeah.
Go fuck yourself.
Ignore Bluey hot takes. Just
go watch Reds. Go watch a grown-up film.
Go watch Reds.
It's a very good show. It's a nice show. And I presume that, you know, anyone who has kids in the next decade, they're still going to love it. Yeah, so that was Bluey.
Is the cynical next 5 years of Bluey, though, that basically the main guy will move on to something else, and then they'll start just churning the fuck out of it, and it loses all of this artistry? Is that what the likely next 5 years is?
I don't know. What was interesting was that for the very latest episode that dropped, that was called Surprise, which was a surprise extra episode that they hadn't announced. in the credits says based on an idea by Stu Heritage, who is a writer for TV writer for The Guardian. He's written a column about it today and saying that the idea that he had was communicated to the creator of the show 3 years ago. So I would imagine if... Because, I mean, Bluey's got steadily bigger and bigger since lockdown, but this is like the crescendo moment. I would imagine that if he does, if that guy does move on and do other things, if he wants to, I don't know, that his impacts will probably be felt for a while. But also, if the, I mean, if the show did end here, there's like 150 episodes and the vast majority of them are great. So, yeah, kind of doesn't matter, I think.
I think that guy is low-key. He could be, I mean, I can't remember his name, to be fair, but he's probably got a, he probably has Hollywood like banging on his door to just do whatever they, whatever he wants. Don't you think? Whatever his name is.
Joe Brum, I believe.
He's just, the work, because I want to say he's written every episode. Is that, am I wrong about that? Like that's it, that's the credit on every episode is him.
That might be right.
And like, and this is, this, I think there's a case that Bluey right now is the biggest TV show in the whole world.
I'm sure, based on like streaming minutes, it absolutely is. Apparently, you know, Disney's tried to buy the rights themselves, and you know, and I'm sure that they would love to have a Bluey theme park. You know, a section in Disney World that's all Bluey, etc.
We'll get there. That's the thing. We'll get there. This is now, this is probably peak Bluey right now. This is like peak the artistry connection.
This is the peak, yeah.
It's all downhill from here.
I should also mention the music on it is superb. And I think that the music goes a long way towards contributing to the quality.
Anyway, just imagining, the world where, like, the next thing he does is he goes and writes like Minions 3 for a big paycheck or whatever. That's where
he writes like a sequel, or he does like a remake of Hardcore or something. He goes like in a proper, really weird direction.
I think as well. I think
he's in his mid-40s, right?
I think he actually came up working on Peppa Pig. Like, I think he interned or like learnt his craft on Peppa Pig and then went, and some other BBC series. Or British series, and then went.
I can fully believe that working on Peppa Pig would make you spend all your time thinking, if I had a TV show, here's what I'd do to make it not shit, and then just doing all those things.
And it is right on, just going on my Wikipedia, he is the sole writer for like 99% of these episodes, the sole writer. And I think he directs a good chunk of the first series as well, so it's you know, it's from the twisted mind of Joe Brum. And if I was Kevin Feige, I'd be like, listen, brother, you know, Avengers 6 in your hand, or you can remake the ultimate. You are going to be in charge of the rebooted MCU.
Hey, Joe, listen, speaking of Kevin Feige, we're going to do a quick news segment here, which is to talk about the Deadpool and Wolverine trailer, which which references Kevin Feige by name. Again,
it does,
because Deadpool knows he's in a movie. What did you guys think of the new Deadpool trailer, which literally dropped today as we're recording?
I thought, once again, this is the Deadpool movies being the most comics accurate version of the X-Men committed to cinema. It is, once again, a monkey paw situation, because it's like, here are those characters you love. We're going to put a load of fucking dick jokes around them now. And that's what, like, I'm sure I will watch Deadpool 3 and have a good time. I don't think I'll ever go back to it. I'm worried by the director, because the previous films he made with Ryan Reynolds were dog shit, so...
He's just been brought in to be a steady hand there, right? This is a Feige and Reynolds joint, and it's like, here is a guy that we know can deliver a movie competently on time and to budget. Crack on.
Yeah, I hope Feige's got some magic left in him, because it's going to take a lot. Like, I enjoyed Deadpool 2 at the time. I don't think I've ever thought about it since I saw it. And I'm worried.
I think if you thought about it too hard, you'd remember it's not very good.
Yeah. The stuff I remember liking is all in Deadpool 1, really. Like the action, and Deadpool 2 didn't have any of that.
Reese, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I had some friends on my WhatsApp being really into it. I don't know that I totally agree with them. It felt like it was really obsessed with showing us that Wolverine said fuck. Like,
you know, he does say that a lot, doesn't he? Yeah.
Half the clips like just featured Hugh Jackman saying that, and I was like, okay. I mean, is that is that a hook for? I wanted more. I was expecting, I think, a bit more story, maybe. That was what I'm waiting for. Took me. Listen, I say that I'll see it anyway. I don't know, like, so maybe they don't need to sell the movie to me. I guess they don't, because I'll see it. But you know, you get a tiny glimpse of Cassandra Nova, right, James?
Mm-hmm.
But there's no, you know, there's no a hint of any of the other cameos. There's no So Emma Corrin, who was announced as the villain, like, yes. She was, you know, they were cast in the movie, and as the villain, but they never said the character's name. And then people have, because there's been tons of set photos for this movie, so stuff has leaked out. And I also think in the first teaser, is it like the back of Emma Corrin's head that you saw, bald head?
Yeah.
Anyway, so
like
people
that.
Thought, is Emma Corrin playing Cassandra Nova, who is a comics character, and in the comics was Xavier's stillborn or a twin sister who was she stillborn or was she? I can't remember.
Xavier
now.
Killed her
evil twin sister
in utero.
Yes, that's right.
And
that's
then right. Her mutant powers allowed her to regrow herself from a cluster of aborted cells.
Incredible.
In a sewer.
Is she the one that's in the Whedon arc? Did you make me read?
No, she's in the Grant Morrison arc that came out around the same time.
I think you
will have read it. Yeah, she's in E for Extinction.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And Emma Corrin, again, it's not named, but is clearly playing her in this movie.
Yeah.
But I guess that could just be what that means. Evil multiverse Xavier, just as easily, right? Do you think?
I mean, it's 100%. It's Cassandra Nova. Like, there's no question about that.
No. She, but I'm saying that could essentially
you'll
be
named
what Cassandra she is.
Nova.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. So yeah, I thought wanted to, but like you don't really see anybody else, which is fine. You know, it will be enough to. I think probably what they're smartly doing is selling it a bit like Spider-Man 3: No Way Home, which is to say everybody knows there's all these other characters in it, but it's not in the trailers at all, and there'll be that excitement on opening weekend of like, oh, you'll never guess who's in this film. And it's like, is it James Marsden and Jennifer Garner? Because that is, I do think so. If it's them, I do know that they'll be in it. And the other thing is, you know, am I a bit disappointed that Hugh Jackman seems to be playing like not the character from the previous films? I think.
Well, wait,
yes, I'm disappointed. You know, there's...
was the Logan character. Was he from?
Good
was
question.
The character? I think the character in Logan was from a different universe to begin with, right?
Well, there was no canonical like statement one way or the other, because X-Men. Which one is it? Ugh. Which one ends? Days of Future Past ends with everyone sort of restored and happy.
Yes.
The other mm-hmm. ones are set in the past. Then the
so that's already Days of Future Past is already a reset timeline by the time you get to the end of it.
Yeah. And then Logan takes place in a non-specific future.
Which could be the original, but I think had enough wiggle room not to be.
I mean, it's worth saying that I'm not sure that the creators of any of these films cared all that much about the
indeed.
Timeline stuff. So why should we? Why should this film?
But you just said you were disappointed. So you care?
Oh, I'm disappointed that this seemingly is not the Hugh Jackman from X2. That's what I
yeah,
take.
Yeah, because there's a line or something where Deadpool's like, "Oh, you failed to save the heroes of your world," or whatever.
Yeah.
So why couldn't that be the?
But we'll see.
Why couldn't that?
I don't have all the answers, Joe. I don't know.
Why couldn't that be the Wolverine of those movies? All it says to me is it's not the Wolverine of Logan, probably. Because he's dead.
It's definitely pre-Logan, whatever's happening. It's pre-Logan, yeah.
I mean, the other thing I thought, James, I don't know if you agree, is because isn't the story in Old Man Logan, the original Old Man Logan comic, that he, like, something he did or didn't do and all the X-Men died because of it?
In,
like,
could in the this original, be... yeah, in the original Old Man Logan, he, I think Mastermind projects an illusion of the villains around him to trick Wolverine into killing the X-Men, yeah. And that's why he stops using his claws, because he's like, I can't be sure who I'm stabbing, so I'm not going to do it anymore.
Potentially,
whereas in this, it's a dick joke.
Could Cassandra Nova, you know, have done that? Could this be like an adaptation of the Old Man Logan storyline? And Cassandra Nova did that to him? I don't know.
It could be, but I also feel like they've done Pacifist Wolverine once, right? So
Sure. So yeah, I think people are excited about this film. People are saying it's going to make $1 billion. For me, I don't know. I wonder whether it's been a bit too long between the Deadpools and the whole. It's just not interesting enough to me, at least. That
I will say.
What if now this character in the MCU? And the Hugh Jackman bit. I don't know. I just don't. I'm weirdly just looking at it with a sort of inner excitement.
I don't know.
What about you?
If it doesn't absolutely crush it at the box office, I think everyone at Disney will be in a blind panic.
Yeah, I think Feige's job will be on the chopping block if it doesn't.
It's
the caveat that it is R-rated, and therefore the expectations of box office will be lower than they would be for, say, an Avengers movie.
I think the expectation is $1 billion. That is a gen, like, that seems to be the industry.
Has any R-rated movie ever done $1 billion? what's the best an R-rated movie has ever done? Can we find that?
Well, Joker broke $1 billion, and Joker was R-rated, so that it'll be that one. Yeah, and obviously that was based on a rather famous character, and he was a bit of a wrong one. but maybe I'm out of step.
Joker's number one.
Oppenheimer's
number two. 969 million. and nice. Then 3 and 4 are Deadpool 2 and Deadpool in the 700 million range.
There you go.
Okay. The Matrix Reloaded.
Yeah. So
it's Logan 619
Matrix
million.
Reloaded was an R.
Yes, apparently.
Jesus.
Yeah. So I agree. I think it has to be up there. When you think about the... And I think you're right about the No Way Home vibes. It's kind of selling itself on. Like, it's the Deadpool vibes, but with all of this huge MCU stuff. And what seems really interesting to me is, obviously, Deadpool is kind of a postmodern take on superheroes anyway, where... the dude knows he's in a comic, then he knows he's in a movie. except now it's like that postmodernism applied within the MCU. And it really does feel like the snake's eating its own tail at this point. Do you guys think? Like all of the stuff in there, like it's all, the whole trailer is references with the 20th Century Fox logo, and then the giant Ant-Man skull, and which, like, I'll admit, it's kind of cool, but I think it's the kind of thing that I think I would have been really excited about 10 years ago. Like, oh, what does that mean? And now, because we're in this multiverse stage where half of the stuff they've put out over the last 2 or 3 years has been bad, I'm just kind of like, okay. And I'm sat there going, I think, like, this is the Kevin Feige cocaine stuff at the end. Did you guys notice that, you know, the first trailer, it had a joke about pegging in it, and like, oh, pegging might be new for Disney, but it's not new for me, Bucko, or whatever it was. And then I saw that same trailer again in a multiplex, and the pegging joke had gone. It was still that line, but pegging had been replaced by something else. I do want, like, I wonder if quite a lot of this stuff has been constructed for the trailers rather than the movie itself.
Yeah, I bet you that cocaine scene, and I thought this when watching the trailer, is not in the movie.
Yes,
and definitely. I bet you that Feige is not. That is not a. That's not a thing that we hear. The only riff on that is, I also and this might be cleverer than these guys will do, but that there could be a character in the story called Feige, and he's Deadpool's new boss or something, and he's the one that doesn't let them do cocaine.
He nicknames Matthew McFadyen Feige.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because you say that, James, they've already kind of did that gag at the end of She-Hulk, right? The robot was called Feige.
Yeah, or
Kevin, maybe. Anyway, so they did that joke already. But yeah, I mean, I'll see it. I really like the posters more than the trailer. You guys see the two posters that they put out today?
Yeah.
Just cool, like, I guess you liked it less than I did.
They're fine. Yeah, they're fine. Whatever.
That you see, Joe, have you seen these?
The Deadpool posters?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's cool. You guys aren't as excited. You see Deadpool's face reflected in Wolverine's claws. You see Wolverine's face reflected in Deadpool's sword. It's cool.
Yeah, I feel like it's weird that you're muted on the trailer. But that those posters have got you hyped.
Because there's like a sort of design engineer. I just like the design piece to it.
Oh dear.
Anyway,
I would say I'm at about 6.5 out of 10 on that.
We'll all go see it. We'll prioritize it for Patreon. It's like the other thing is box office. It's kind of got a free run, doesn't it? Like that is, if you want a superhero movie, there you go. Which is mad.
For the
first time in a decade, that's it. Hey, do you want a superhero movie? We've got Madame Web for you at the start of the year, and we've got Craven at the end. Anything else? Yes, and you're going to see it. Or all of Hollywood gets made redundant.
I just hope this gives Hugh Jackman the juice he needs to retire.
Well, you mean retire from Wolverine, or you mean retire from
Wolverine? Yeah, because
go and make another musical
let him do his song and dance thing.
Hot young fuck out of Euphoria or something, take over for the Phase 11 of the MCU.
He is 100% going to be in Secret Wars.
I hope they've recorded that cameo now.
Stan Lee's going to be in the movie. Secret Wars.
There's no more MCU big movie star actors anymore. They all fucked off. So you're going to have to go back and find the old guys and put them in.
Who's the big cameo now that you could, like, who is the Marvel?
You can't. The only big cameo you can get now is Robert Downey Jr. That's the only one people are going to be like, but I mean
from like Marvel movies, not MCU movies. Marvel movies. Like, who's the
Wesley Snipes?
Who's the big one that could turn up in Secret Wars? Nick Cage,
Roger Corman.
Nick Cage Ghost Rider would be fun,
which will happen probably. Yeah. Something like that.
I mean, maybe not after that. I mean, Superman cameo,
in the Flash,
Ben Affleck, and Wesley Snipes.
Will he?
Yeah, of course he will.
You think he will?
Yeah, he's got to pay alimony.
Who else could show up?
Maybe they could get Brandon.
They've done the big ones. They've done Wolverine and Patrick and Professor X and the Spider-Mans. Yeah.
James Marsden. That's who we're looking for.
Well,
Cyclops is cool again.
Yeah, he'll be in this.
Don't know if you heard, Joe. Cyclops is cool again. So.
Great.
Yeah, Cyclops is so cool, man.
Because of 97?
Yeah.
Cool.
Hell yeah.
When is that whole series going to be up?
Two more weeks?
No, I think three more weeks left on the clock, yeah.
I'll binge it then, promise.
Good for you.
Binge it.
I might watch Werewolf by Night.
Yeah, good for you. Some of us are real fans.
Not me. Okay, that's we talked for an hour and a half on other stuff we've been watching and news. I feel like maybe you guys are putting this off, but let's let's move
on. 25 to discuss 20 on DFL. DFL.
Okay, so guys, let's talk about. Let me take you back to 1933. We're going to talk about Design for Living. I'll do a quick bit of setup because I'm aware not many of our listeners will have will still be listening. Not many of our listeners will have watched will have watched this movie or know about it relative to you know, some of the other stuff we discussed. So Design for Living was directed by Ernst Lubitsch, who is kind of famous for, at his peak, his movies were described as having the Lubitsch touch, which was that basically kind of, and throughout the 30s especially, that everything he made kind of like was critically and with audiences really successful, and kind of like had this, they were light on their feet, they were funny, and there was just something about what Lubitsch brought to them that kind of made them a cut above what you would get from most of the other films in the genre. So Design for Living is a rom-com, and I picked it, as I said earlier, that because I think it has parallels with Challengers, which is Luca Guadagnino's new movie with Zendaya and Mike Feist and Josh O'Connor, which is coming out next month, Reese? This month? Next month?
It's coming out. It's coming out on Friday. And I should tell you that I'd forgotten. This is a very quick tangent. I'd forgotten that there was some Challengers DNA in this. And tonight, my friend who runs his cinema had a preview screening of Challengers, and I said, "I'm sorry, I can't. I've got to both watch and then pod on this fucking 1933 movie." And then, as I get about an hour in, I'm like, "Oh, this is sort of like Challengers. Cool. Okay.
Yeah.
It comes out on Friday.
So this stars Frederick March, Gary Cooper, and Miriam Hopkins as kind of like the central trio. And then there is Edward Everett Horton, who is like the kind of the stick in the mud opposite them. And it's a love triangle movie. So the two guys are friends. They meet this girl. They kind of both fall for her separately and then discover that both of... And I'm just going to go into spoilers here because no one cares. They find out that each of them has been having a explicitly referred to as a sexual relationship with her. And then they enter into eventually a gentleman's agreement where basically they're all going to stay friends and none of them are going to, they're going to keep sex out of it. They're just going to remain friends. And she is going to almost act as like their muse. He's Gary Cooper's a painter and Frederick March is a playwright. And she kind of inspires them and drives them on by kind of like negging one and building up the other to be successful in their chosen fields. Then one of them leaves for London. She ends up then getting into a relationship with the guy that's with Gary Cooper, who was left behind. Then eventually Frederick March comes back and she sleeps with him. And it is this really subversive, especially for the time. This is a pre-code movie. Which
you can tell that it's pre-code. In fact, isn't this one of the movies that struggled to get a release because they introduced the Hays Code? They were like,
I believe we need
to stop this kind of filth.
I believe it's that they couldn't re-release it. So they wanted to re-release it many times in the years following, and the Hays Code kind of prevented them from putting it back in cinemas. Yeah. But it does some of the, because it's after the code had been established, but before it was being strictly enforced. So it kind of, it does kind of talk around, you know, it's not like explicit, and it does kind of like leave you to fill in some of the gaps, but then also makes it certain, you know, makes it clear what is happening. It's essentially this love triangle movie. And I was watching one of the special features. I've got the Criterion Blu-ray. And one of the special features was quoting from an essay about the film that said, in terms of its subversivity, it kind of breaks taboos at the time around premarital virginity, fidelity, monogamy, marriage, and one-to-one love relationships. That it kind of breaks down all of those five taboos that, like, you know, we're talking about a couple of years before you can't show a married couple sleeping in the same bed, right? It's it got super strict, and yeah, and this movie is kind of really subversive with that stuff, but also kind of really feminist in that it tries to as well break down some of the gender norms of the time, and I think that still exists now around, you know, like who, you know, what is expected of a woman versus a man when they are, when they're entering into relationships, certainly with multiple partners. And I just, I really fucking love it. It's one of, I watched all of Lubitsch's talkies and some of his silent movies a couple of years ago, and this is in my top three of his talkies. My favorite is Trouble in Paradise, which is actually, like, I would say kind of like a sister movie to this one almost. Miriam Hopkins is in that as well, and it's playing with similar ideas, but didn't have quite the tie into challenges that this one did, so I went for Design for Living. And yeah, I really love it, and this is kind of one of those movies that this is the stuff that I like to watch in my free time. I love delving through cinema history and kind of, you know, going into these filmographies of these, you know, these names like Lubitsch. And when I find a movie like this that I fall head over heels for, it feels like such a discovery, but in plain sight. And so I thought that I would, as I said, bring you guys in on my bullshit this week, to take you back to the 1930s and kind of get a view from you as, guys that know about and appreciate film, but maybe don't spend as much time watching films from this era as I do. Like how it plays to you, because I do think there is a, I do think I've had to kind of adjust to the rhythms of cinema from different eras. Like even if you go back to 70s cinema, right, it's the kind of the cinematic language and the pace is very different. You know, we saw that with Reds, didn't we? But if you're going back 100 years, it's even more pronounced. So how did you guys find this kind of at first glance? And do you think I'm insane, or did you have a good time?
So that was one of the points I was going to make, actually, which is that, like, the further back in the past you go to watch a movie, the more pronounced it becomes, like, how sort of nascent the art form is. So, like, I was surprised, actually, by how modern this feels in terms of the themes and the writing.
Yeah.
The thing I find harder to engage with is the just sort of undercooked technical aspects. Because it is just like they've got a stage, they point the camera at the stage, and then they follow the actors around it, and they don't cut, and they don't close up. And, like, occasionally you'll get different takes woven together, but not in a way that preserves the continuity very well, because presumably there wasn't a lot of coverage. So things like that, like, it's in black and white, and the two guys are dressed the same and look the same. It's hard sometimes to follow that action.
So that's interesting, James, because actually Hollywood movies of that era, Hollywood, you know, I know you said kind of like the art form was nascent, but it was more so in Hollywood, right? Because Hollywood kind of took the art form and commercialized it. And so you did have, you know, you've got loads of very experimental stuff with editing and camera movement, and there are loads of complex art forms in the silent era, partly from Hollywood going to talkies, kind of restricted a lot of that, but also Hollywood talkies were intentionally designed for the audience to have to do as little work as possible. So okay. it was very much like, what are the simplest camera setups? Let's have all of the action, you know, kind of everything you need to follow is unfolding in the foreground. And actually, for the era, this film particularly is asking the audience to do a little bit more. So it is kind of leaving ellipses in between scenes where it's going, how did we get from this point to that point? And it's there for you. It's there for you in the visual language of the movie, but it's not there.
It's not like they have a title card saying, you know, 6 months later or whatever.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And
stuff like, like the scene at the end of the movie where Miriam Hopkins has just got married to the marketing guy. Ooh, marketing guys. And the worst, right? And she gets married to him. She receives these two tulips from Tom and what's the other guy's name?
George,
yeah.
Tom and George. And she kind of, she goes, she initially knocks it over and then she leaves her marital room to go back and put the tulips back in. And so that is kind of this metaphor for, you know, you can see that she's still kind of, you know, even if she's trying to forget them, she's still kind of tending to that relationship. She then goes back into the bedroom, the door closes, the lights dim to go to kind of nighttime and then pick back up to go to daytime. So you see that there has been this jump in time forward to the next morning. The husband walks out of the room, walks over to the tulips and kicks them over. And so in that sequence, you're kind of told where she is mentally. You are told that they went into their wedding bedroom on their wedding, you know, their marital bed on their wedding night, and he comes out kicking over the tulips because they didn't consummate. And so that's the kind of stuff that Lubitsch is doing that, you know, in another movie would maybe be a bit more spelled out.
Sure. And part of me thinks maybe what I'm blaming on the form being undeveloped is partly because it's based on a play, like, very loosely by all reports.
Very loosely.
But, like, that's the sort of thing I see when modern plays are adapted, which is that they're dialogue heavy, their location work is quite static. Like, that sort of stuff applies now as then. So, you know, it's a two-hander. Anyway, all of that said, I thought it was pretty good, you know. It's not the sort of film I would have watched off my own back. You know, I'm not going to rave about it, but I enjoyed it. And like I say, the thing that landed most for me is that the ideas and the execution of the story was modern. I appreciated that, especially because I think I've said before, I'm working my way through the book by, I've forgotten her name. God, I'm so bad with names today. Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, it's called.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm working my way through the book that movie was based on, which is The Secret History of Wonder Woman, sorry.
And so you're getting your polyamory fix.
Yeah, and like it's, you know, well. It's that stuff is happening around the same time, like 1930s, 1940s, questioning the role of women in society and the role of family and the alternative arrangements that people can come to. So for me, it was making a nice companion piece to that.
Reese?
I kind of had the opposite view of you, James, which is that I actually found this, all the technical side of things really, really, really interesting. You know, the costuming, there's that scene a little bit earlier than the one you're just describing, Joe, where they go into the bed sort of shop, and then you get it shot from like outside the window, and you can hear the sounds of the cars, and then you kind of wordlessly see, and this is when she's marrying the evil marketing guy. Ooh, boo, marketing, boo. And then they're sort of measuring the bed. And then basically he's saying, you know, he's sort of saying, no, this bed isn't big enough for the two of us. And what you're inferring from what she's saying is, oh no, this is my bed for me. I'll be in this by myself. But then all of that's happening quite quickly, quite wordlessly, and I just thought that was a really well put together short scene, and then similarly, the scene you described earlier, like totally, like that was a really just great. That's just really good filmmaking.
There's a bit earlier as well that I really like, where they kind of resolve. So they find out that each other, that the two guys find out that they're both sleeping with Gilda, and they kind of are initially both upset. They're upset with each other. And also the way that they use that line that he then uses in the play to discover it, I just think is really neat how that line comes back three times and causes a revelation for the character on each occasion. So they end that scene with, right, we're going to ring her up, or she rings up and it's like, right, we've got to tell her that this is over. We're not going to see her anymore. She's out of our lives. And then Gary Cooper's on the phone to her and she says something like, he's like, oh, she wants to meet up. And he's about to say something. You see him go to speak, and then we dissolve, and then we go to the next day, and he is in the shop getting his dress shirt laundered or whatever, you know, getting the shirt ready, which he just previously agreed that he wasn't going to need to wear anymore because he wouldn't need to impress Gilda. So that... And you see, there's like a 2 minute wordless sequence there, which is just the two of them kind of preparing for this meeting again.
So I liked the filmmaking around that had some, you know, just was interesting to me. The performance, like, I don't think I've ever seen, I can't remember seeing a Gary Cooper performance, let alone the other two. So just sort of watching their performances, and obviously it's a different, you know, it's a different style of acting. And I didn't bring it up earlier, but I saw Wednesday on the Waterfront for the first time this past weekend in cinemas. Course. And then you just can see, and I know it is a cliche and it's what everyone says. So I went into it expecting that, but I did experience it myself, where you basically see all these other actors doing the kind of old style of acting, and Marlon Brando creates what is acting now. He creates it right there on the screen in front of you. It's kind of incredible. It was just a different era of acting, but there was, you know, interesting stuff to that. For me, I just sort of bounced off of the, you know, because when you were reading through the story, Joe, what I think listeners can't quite won't realize is that when you hit those story beats, that isn't sort of five scenes where that story beat happens in pieces. Like that, it's almost like a scene each for each of those like dramatic story beats. You know, they cover this story. This 90-minute movie covers. It's almost like epic in scale, kind of. It's sort of, you know, covers this grand, you know, this really big shift in these characters' lives.
Yeah.
But I just had a bit of whiplash, I think, from the fact that these moments in the way the love triangle evolves, it's like it's within like a 5 minute scene, and then you're on to the next like chapter of.
And there are these big transitions, and like the next time you see a character
a year later, yeah.
Just the way, but just and it's not spelled out to you. It's just the way that they're dressed suggests like,
oh, they're rich now.
Now he's made a success out of his art, or that's. Or now that relationship's together, and like, or like, you know, Frederick March reads a letter and you don't know what's on the letter, but you just, you know, you're just immediately told kind of through his reaction that he's found out about the relationship, that kind of stuff.
And the initial setup where the sort of, and again, I think this is just, it was 90 years ago, but sort of they meet in a single scene on a train, the three of them. And then the next scene, they are all in love with each other. You know, or she is in love with both of them, and they're in love with her. And you've got to be able to vibe with that kind of speed. and I guess there's stuff unspoken, and there's stuff that's just, you've got to be able to jive with that. And this afternoon at whatever 7:15, I just found the first half of this quite head spinning. But I think, I enjoyed the second half more. Because you almost get a slightly more extended period of time with that last chunk where she's, you know, she's getting married and then will be married. And then the two guys are kind of, you know, sort of have gone to find her. But even that, I mean, as I say it, I'm like, why have they gone to find her? You know, have they just gone to take her away from her husband, which they do.
Yeah, but that's, yeah.
But yeah, they do. Because, that's what the heck happened.
Because off screen, what has happened is those two characters have gone, do you know what? I want to be with that girl. You want to be with that girl. We're both miserable not being with her.
And she's going to be miserable with Max.
Yeah. Yeah. We know that she's going to be miserable. Let's form a new gentleman's agreement where this time we figure it out. This time the rule isn't sex is off the table. This time it's this time it's just we all be fucking. What's interesting, James? You said that about the dialogue and it feeling quite stagey with its setups and stuff. But you are right that it's a very loose adaptation. It's of a Noel Coward play, and Noel Coward is like a name brand playwright. But his whole thing is dialogue, and you know, as we've already said, like the movie opens up with like a dialogue free sequence, and there are these, you know, kind of pauses in the movie, in between these kind of key scenes that often do go wordlessly. And what I thought was interesting as well was this isn't something I was aware. Sometimes it does feel like there are. It's not like snappy, fast dialogue like you'll get from His Girl Friday, a decade later, once Howard Hawks starts pioneering that kind of overlapping dialogue style. What you get here is sometimes often like big pauses after someone says something, and that's because Lubitsch was leaving in space for the audience laughter to die down. Because if he's got something that he's like, in 1933, this is gonna fucking bring the house down. And the stuff. So this again was something that I discovered from the special features. There's this scene in Trouble with Paradise, which is his film, I think, which came out a year earlier, where the villain of the movie espouses his mantra, or not the villain, but the protagonist, who's also a thief, espouses his mantra, and his dialogue in that sequence is basically like Herbert Hoover's campaign platform. It would be like a carrot saying "Yes, we can," or "Make America Great Again" in a movie now, and we just immediately know what that's a reference to. And it was a Herbert Hoover line that was put into the mouth of a thief, and then he leaves like a 3-4 second pause after he said it because he's like, I know that that's going to kill with this audience. It was literally released the day of the election. And he was like, this is just going to bring the house down. And it did. So you have like this 4 seconds of silence where a character walks away and does some business before he starts up again. And I think there's some of that in here, and some of that, you know, I think probably for us, but watching it back, like, I imagine that you guys are like, when there are funny bits in here, there are wry chuckles, right? Rather than, you know,
I got a couple of laugh out louds moments.
Yeah, but
I forget,
you know, it's
what
not,
they were, but yeah.
You're not, but especially, you know, back in the 30s when cinemas were literally, these screenings would have been packed to the rafters, and you would have, you know, you've got a person in every seat, so a laugh line does need that kind of that pause, which I thought was is something that I'd never thought about watching films from this era, but it's a really nice note.
Makes a lot of sense. I mean, I was thinking when I was watching this about His Girl Friday being one of the few movies from that era that I've actually seen. But I was thinking like, oh, this is kind of like proto Screwball, and it's sort of comedy and dialogue heavy stuff. It felt, I can see how you get from that, this in the 30s to that in the 40s, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk about some of the cast. So Gary Cooper, who I think is best known these days for James Gandolfini saying, "Whatever happened to Gary Cooper?" in the pilot of The Sopranos, like the strong silent type, and he's best known for High Noon, I think, which he made later in his career. But yeah, early in his career, he was. He's in some. I've, seen quite a bit of Gary Cooper stuff from around this era, because he was in a couple of movies with Marlene Dietrich, and he's in another, I think he worked with Lubitsch later on, Bluebeard's Eighth Wife, which he's also very good in. He did some Capra stuff, obviously. He's in Mr. Deeds Goes to Town and Meet John Doe. Ball of Fire, which is a Howard Hawks movie, James, which is amazing that he's in with Barbara Stanwyck, and I would definitely recommend that to anyone as well. I kind of just love his screen persona at this time, of this kind of like affable lunk, this kind of folksy kind of guy who definitely, you know, he feels like the lowest status of the two in this movie. His success comes later, and he's just a bit of a goof.
His clothes are literally falling off him at some point.
Yes, he's jumping into the bed where the dust literally rises up around him, which is great.
I love
that that's like this movie's equivalent of like a steamy bed, you know, like a steamy bedroom scene is the dust steaming up off the like squalor bed. But yeah, I think Gary Cooper is great in this. Frederick March is, and I think Gary Cooper's one of those guys that when he's in a movie, you definitely notice him. Going back to this era, Frederick March, who, you know, was hugely successful and I think won multiple Oscars. He does have the ability to sink into the background a little bit more, but I think they work up this really nice double act here. And I kind of love the relationship that they have, which is, it's adversarial, but also they are ultimately friends. And I love that line that Frederick March has about, like, when Miriam Hopkins says, why are you more mad at me than, why have you forgiven him but not me? And he's like, because he chose you over me. And I get that, but you chose him over me, which just seems. And what's it? I think he says, which is an incredible choice.
in the old sense of not incredible.
Yes.
there's also that great. There's the great sequence where they get drunk, which I really liked.
Mm.
It's after she's left Frederick March. And they just have this, again, versus what I was saying earlier, quite lengthy for the movie scene where they're sipping some kind of booze and getting progressively drunk. And it's the scene starts with them. And this is, again, your head can spin a bit in this. The scene starts and what's just happened is, Gary Cooper, who's been with this woman for a year, and Frederick March just turns up out of the blue, shags her, and then she fucks off, and that's what's just happened to these two men. And yet within the space of whatever, a 4-minute scene, they can get from there to we're pals again. It's a lot, but the movie in that scene told it for me that those characters had gone through that,
and then have that lovely little kind of back and forth about who they should be toasting to.
Yeah,
because it's uncouth to toast themselves, but they can't toast to nobody. and then Miriam Hopkins, I just think she's wonderful in this. She's also in Trouble in Paradise, and she's in The Smiling Lieutenant as well, which is a Lubitsch film with Maurice Chevalier, who is a star of a number of his early 30s films, and highly recommend anyone goes back and watch Maurice Chevalier for movies, because he was a movie star like no other. The most French man who has ever lived. He's wonderful. I stuck on the Aristocats on Disney Plus to watch with Genevieve, I think, and we didn't last long. They weren't into it, but the opening song of the Aristocats, which is set in France, is just an older Maurice Chevalier kind of speak singing the song. I was just like, oh yeah, because that's what Hollywood does to put you in France. It goes, Maurice, give us some of your patter. But yeah, Miriam Hopkins, who's in this and in Trouble in Paradise, I just think she's like great in this, and I think she also. Because she is the driving force of the narrative, in terms of like it's her until the very end, when they go, oh, can we exert some influence on this as well? She's the one who's making all the decisions. She's the one who's deciding, you know, who she wants to be with, why she wants to be with them, or deciding that, you know, they shouldn't have sex, etc. They should just be kind of friends. But I think because of that, because she's in that position of power within the triplet, that she kind of really is able to bring the sex appeal as well, and that they are. She kind of makes it rom-com sexy in a way that those two don't as much. And I'm not just saying this as a heterosexual man, I'm saying this as like they are kind of more often the butt of the jokes than she is, so she kind of gets to own it a little bit more, and I think she just properly does, and she's great. What do you guys think of Miriam?
Yeah, you, I think you can. I agree with all of that, and I think you can see, again, we haven't seen Challengers, but I suspect that, yeah, you know, Zendaya is the lead of that movie, and I think from the trailers and reviews, it sounds like she's the one that's sort of driving the narrative, and you know, and it's her decisions, and even you can see it in the trailer, right? That in seemingly the inciting incident of that movie is when she has a sort of three-way with the two lads,
and she puts their hands on her leg, right? In the trailer, right? Is that doesn't she take both of their hands and put them on her legs?
Yeah.
And that again, yeah, well, you know, there's a moment of that in the opening sequence of Design for Living, where the two guys wake up on the train and her legs are on the seat in between them, and his hand has fallen down onto her leg, and it's this kind of, am I dreaming, am I awake moment. And I think just this really, really kind of evocative and indicative moment of the rest of the film, of like this is the sensuality that this movie's going to have. It is going to be about human beings touching.
Yeah, and I like that, because I haven't seen any films from this era, and I feel like often if there's a love triangle or there's multiple partners, it's clear who the movie is setting up for the lead to end up with, right? Whether it's, you know, more, I guess I've seen more often a man and multiple women, and then there's a clear lead love interest. In this, I don't feel like it's just neither of them, right? And that's true from the beginning. And that, I bet you at the time, that felt, as a general movie going, 1933, that just felt odd. That just, in a good way, like just gave this film a flavor that you hadn't seen before.
So that special feature that I was talking about, Reese, about the all of the different subversive elements of this movie, the thing that the guy on the special feature builds on there is that he's like, and the final thing that is truly subversive, or the final taboo that it kind of breaks, is the rom-com itself. Because, rom-coms, even then, the expectation is your movie ends with the couple getting together, and this movie kind of does. It's just that one side of that couple has two parts.
And I love that. I love the scene, the opening, the setup of that dynamic where she says, "I don't like him. I'm very fond of him." And then the one guy's like, "Oh, so I guess you'll choose him." And then she says the same thing to the other one, and it's her way of saying, "I'm not. I just refuse to choose between who you. I'm really, you know, very fond of both of you, but we shouldn't have sex anymore." Like for me, what I thought was then about to happen was, well, we should, I guess, be in like a polycule. You know, obviously not using that word, but I just didn't really get why she wanted to just be friends with the two of them without a sexual piece. That maybe that's just a thing that would be too culturally, you know, too.
But that's where the
too provocative at the time.
But that's where the movie ends. Yeah,
yeah.
And I guess that, you know, cultural taboos exist within the world of the movie as well, right? So that sure. probably felt like an option that wasn't really on the table. And also, I think probably at that point in the film, neither of the men, if it had been suggested in that sequence, neither of the men would have been able to accept it, I think. Mm.
Yeah, fair.
And I love in that sequence, though, when she's talking about, she uses the metaphor of them both being like different types of hats. And I love I love some of the language that she uses as well, that is just like kind of wonderful double entendre when she's talking about when she puts each of them on, when she's describing them as hats. Yeah. And then there's also the moment when she said, when she's talking about when she, about how, you know, she's, they both found out that she's sleeping with both of them. She's like, and she's like, a thing happened to me that usually happens to men. you kind of read that immediately as like, it's like, oh, she orgasmed with them. And that's the, and then she starts talking about this tingly feeling that goes up from her feet with one of them, and the one that goes down from her head with the other one. And yeah, just this kind of, yeah, very kind of evocative sexual language that's always, like I say, there is they're still skirting around some stuff, but also able to be really progressive for the time for what they're depicting. I also love that when in that sequence, after they agree not to have sex, you literally see them having the bed removed. Anything else that you guys wanted to call out that you liked or disliked about this?
This is more a general thing about the movie, but one of the things I found sort of oddly haunting about this film is, aside from the fact everyone who made this movie is 100% dead, like, I was mentally placing this like, oh, this comes between World War One and World War Two, and these people, like, they don't know where this is going. Like, they have literally lived through one world war and are on the cusp of a second.
They're also, this is like a Depression era movie as well. They're like coming out of the Great Depression.
And I found it really interesting how, like, tonally and sort of emotionally, like, it doesn't seem interested in any of that. And it kind of, it gives you a window into how people existed in the shadow of, like, this, you know, history-altering event. I just found that a really interesting perspective.
James, that's one of the things that I also kind of love about going back and watching, especially taking directors sometimes and watching their films in chronological order. Like I was saying with Spike Lee, and about how you can see, like, through the 90s, the conversations that he was having about the black experience were, you know, they're different in the late 80s than they are in the late 90s. Yeah. And Lubitsch is a, you know, really interesting one. Lubitsch was a German director. He started his career in Germany and worked in, he made some very awful comedies as his first couple of films. Then made some, like, really incredible silent comedies once he'd figured it out, and I think crucially as well, taking himself off screen because he stars in a couple of the early ones. He then has this career kind of making these kind of, like, more epic in scope silent movies around, like, historical figures, and then moves over to Hollywood in the mid-20s, makes some silent movies, and then kind of his talkies. I think his first talkie is The Love Parade, maybe? It's one of the Chevalier movies. And I know, actually, I think it might be The Smiling Lieutenant, which is another Chevalier movie. But anyway, starts making talkies, makes these kind of string of really, really great, primarily romantic comedies, a couple of deviations. And then in the late 30s, he makes Nanochka and The Shop Around the Corner. You might know The Shop Around the Corner. That's a, it was kind of adapted to become You've Got Mail in the late 90s. Mm. And then, you know, he's then a German director working in Hollywood as the Second World War is starting. And Nanochka is about a Soviet woman, a Soviet officer who was sent to Paris, I believe. And, you know, there are vibes in that. But then he has To Be or Not to Be, which is a film set around an acting troupe during the German occupation of Poland. And kind of this... it is comedic. This kind of like farce, but like with the, you know, real world kind of terrifying Nazi occupation stuff around the borders, and like genuine threat for the lead characters in the movie. So it's, you know, it's something that became a, you know, a factor in his cinema as well as just being, you know, as well as like you're saying, this looming threat, it becomes a narrative in his films too.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Reese, any final observations from you?
No. My biggest thing from the whole film was that it was much less sort of screwball-y and kind of rat-a-tat-tat than I was expecting. Mm. Initially a bad, a negative way, and then as I, you know, just got with the vibe of it, a positive way. You know, it was kind of, yeah, it was a bit more naturalistic than I was expecting. In an interesting way, you know, I did struggle with the humor. I felt like almost all the laugh lines, I just didn't get there with the movie. I just sort of thought, yeah. And also, you know, interesting as a Noel, I read something on the Wikipedia saying that Noel Coward kind of rejected the adaptation, and it was, you know, he said that there was only a single line that remained from his script. I'm sure that's slightly facetious, but and you know, it's interesting that kind of you know, even 90 years ago, the Hollywood adapting, you know, written work from other mediums and then bastardizing it or changing it a lot to the chagrin of the writer. Like, oh, that's nothing's changed there.
No, I think that's basically true. Most, a lot of Lubitsch's movies, he adapted from like not very well known, or a lot of his earlier movies anyway, like not very well known plays from Europe. So he could kind of bring this story that no one knew, adapt it, and basically change the whole thing and no one would notice. And he basically did that to Noel Coward as well. It just so happened that a lot more people were familiar with this, and I think it had opened like less than a year before the movie was released. So
it is mad. It is mad to take a Noel Coward play and then scrap the dialogue of all things.
Yeah, yeah.
When I read that, I was like, oh, why? Like when there was that wordless scene, I was like, surely this couldn't have been in the play.
Mm.
But yeah.
I think it works, though. I think it works, you guys.
Oh, it works, yeah. It works.
And I found Gary Cooper's face just very interesting throughout. Like, just, wow, that's a face that just really popped. You said that Frederick March blend into the background a bit more. You know, he just has a bit of a sort of squishier face, whereas Gary Cooper, and, you know, he was like 8 feet tall and like, you know, it felt like his body was almost getting lost in those suits.
And that,
very tall, sort of sturdy man with a great face
and the hairline as well. He's got that kind of like the definitive widow's peak.
Yeah, yeah, you can see the little the triangle on his head, right? Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you showed this to us. I didn't love it like you love it. But I'm glad I watched it. And long may this continue. Films that we can watch that are from olden times. But yeah, struggled with it a bit. I mean, I'm not going to lie, I struggled with it more than I would have liked. Yeah, a bit,
a bit. I will just end by calling out, I think my biggest laugh in the movie is when George and Tom turn up at the end and they kind of reveal themselves in the bedroom to Gilda, and they're all laughing on the bed, and her husband comes in, and they just both silently stand up and both walk around the screen that they were hiding around originally and lower themselves back behind it. it just really tickles me. And I think as well, because they reemerge in that final sequence of the movie, just as like, oh, we know what we're doing now. We've come to terms with the situation we're in. We're going to own it. And essentially, we are two silly little fuckboys, and we're gonna go into this prim and proper world, and we're gonna tear it up, and we're gonna walk away with the girl who belongs in our world, not theirs. They've kind of both met her now on her wavelength, and they can break her out of that prison. I really love it, and it was fun. It was fun to have an opportunity to talk about it. James,
yes,
you're up next, I think, with selecting a film to discuss on the podcast. So, do you have a corrective to a 1933 romantic comedy?
I wish I did. I've been going back and forth between my three options.
Ooh,
I'm gonna throw some some lines at you, and I'm going to let you two choose your fate. So,
obviously, there are two of us, so we pick different ones.
We'll see. I'll have the deciding choice, obviously. But there is. I'm going to try and keep it fairly secret what I'm thinking of. So. One is a film noir set in New York. Another is a Japanese independent movie. And the other is a different film noir set in New York. But it is also twice the length of the other one.
I would like a film noir set in New York.
Yeah.
I would like the Japanese film.
Okay.
Okay, and I would like the shorter film noir set in New York.
Ooh. Okay, so that gives me the deciding factor.
I feel like
we've
not helped him there, Reese.
So what I'm going to do is, just because I think we should be mindful that we have an audience, I'm not going to do the black and white film from 1949. So I'm afraid Joe's losing out. This time. Maybe next time, though, I'll go for that one. So the film that you're looking for the next podcast is called Kamikaze Girls. You can get it on Amazon. It was released on DVD and I think Blu-ray by Third Window, who are a great distributor of Japanese independent cinema, and it's not often I become like a distributor nerd, but there was a period where I was buying every DVD that Third Window put out, and this was one of them. I haven't watched it since I bought it about 15 years ago, so I'm looking forward to seeing how it holds up.
When's the film from?
It's from 2004, sorry.
James.
I think, guys, we are getting less... We are getting more obscure as we go on. We started with Poor Things, which is a film that came out 2 weeks before that got Oscar nom. Then we went to Shortcomings, 2 years old, Randall Park directed, fine. Then we went to Reds, which is a movie that came out 50 years ago. Now we've gone to...
Well, listen, tick-tick-boom, Caroline gave us a short amount of salvation.
We're going to half count that. And then now we're going to a Japanese independent film that came out 20 years ago. This is good. I don't know how we get more obscure, but maybe we could try it. We can watch one of your old pornos, Joe. How about
that? I can't believe it took us 2 hours to get to an old pornos joke. I was expecting that up front.
James, can we do a bit of, Jim Bowen on Bullseye? Can we take a look at what we could have won? What were the other two that you were?
Well, so the long film noir was Motherless Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
Ooh, I would have liked that. Which
I loved, but didn't get a great reception. So I'm keen to revisit it and see if I'm a fan. So maybe next time. And the other one was The Window from 1949.
Oh.
I'm trying to remember. Ted Tetzkoff, I think it is. Does that sound right, Joe?
Ted Tetzlaff. I'm sticking all of this into Letterboxd as we go along.
Yeah, because I was having a sort of New York moment with cinema. I mean, I'm always having a New York moment with cinema. It's an ongoing strand of mine where I'm like, what film in New York can I watch today? And that was a really good one. Like, I kind of bounce off film noir quite a lot. But that The Window was one that I really enjoyed. So maybe we'll go to that another time.
Excellent. Okay, so Kamikaze Girls next week. Are you guys going to do more X-Men 97 on the Patreon?
I think at some point. Yes.
There's one episode already, right?
Yeah, covering episodes 1 to 3 of the season. And we'll try and catch up so that we're podcasting by, same week by the end.
Ooh, amazing.
That gives us a few weeks to catch up, but...
Yes.
Cool. And then once it finishes, I'll binge it, and I'll tell you what I thought. I'll probably go,
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
Cool. Okay, so thank you for indulging that to the one listener who's still with us.
We talked about fucking Wolverine and Deadpool for
come on.
Yeah, we gave you and Fallout. Come on,
Bluey.
Man. Come on.
We played the hits. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Goodbye, podcast.
Goodbye, podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.